We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
In our first hour of our telephone talk show at 10 o'clock, we are speaking with the person we talk to once a month on the questions of personal finance and investment. He is a University of Illinois finance professor, David Sinnoh. And David, good to see you on the show this morning. And this is the first time that I've done a finance show with you. So I know that you have prepared comments as we begin the show. So take it away.
Well, I do, Tom. And good morning to yourself and all of the wonderful listeners at WILL. As always, of course, it's a genuine pleasure to be with you, and obviously there are many financial topics we could visit about this morning. For example, we could talk about record low mortgage rates, and of course the flip side of interest rates, abysmal savings, CD, and money market rates. How disappointed we are when we put money in savings down at our local financial institutions and earn very, very little interest on those savings. Or we could spend some time fretting about a very high unemployment rate of approximately 10%, at least as reported by the Bureau of Labor Statistics, although we know that the real rate of unemployment is approximately 16%. Some people put it as high as 17 or 18 when adding the underemployed or simply people who have just given up looking for a job altogether. And it really should come as no surprise that initial claims for unemployment benefits rose to 500,000 new claims just last week, which was the fourth increase in the last 5 weeks. And new claims, of course, were the highest since last November. Another area of fertile discussion involves those investors who hold relatively high-yielding long-term municipal bonds. That's a very important area if you have those kinds of investments, especially since that historically municipal bonds have rarely defaulted. In fact, defaults have been in about the 1% area. In other words, when you bought a municipal bond in the past, you had about a 99% certainty that that bond was going to repay all of its principal as well as all of the interest coupons. However, with the financial difficulties now facing many states, Illinois among them, and political subdivisions of states, that default rate is likely to increase. So it's an important issue, and maybe if you hold those kinds of financial instruments, talk with your financial advisor as to the credit quality of those particular instruments. We could spend some time examining income tax rates, in which it is a virtual certainty that federal income tax rates will increase, at least for wealthy Americans, in 2011. Tax rates are already scheduled to increase from a current 35% marginal rate to 39.6% marginal rate for our more wealthy Americans. And here's an interesting statistic. The top 1% of income earners in the United States pay 40% of all federal income taxes collected, which is actually more than the bottom 90% of all wage earners. So really the top 1% and really the top 1 to 10% pay the lion's share of all federal income tax. And of course, there is substantial support in Congress to change the long-term capital gains rate from 15% to 20%. And a lot of businesses, a lot of entrepreneurs, a lot of people considering going into business really dislike that idea because there's an old saying that capital moves where capital is treated best. And when we raise capital gains rates, that's a negative for treating capital best. Interestingly enough, against this backdrop of very tough economic news, public corporations are reporting record profits. Every day we're reading in the Wall Street Journal and other financial journals that profits are up. In fact, they are sitting on record sums of cash, estimated as high as $3 trillion, and not redeploying these vast sums by investing these assets in their businesses, which really means hiring employees. Remember that 6 out of 10 permanent jobs in our economy are created by small businesses, 9 out of 10 permanent jobs are created by business in general, not by government. Now, there are any number of reasons for U.S. businesses to hold back on hiring these new employees. For example, weak consumer demand, big surprise. Weak consumer spending, as we know, obviously, that consumers have cut back. Small businesses are especially concerned about their difficulty and their ability to borrow money, as banks are reticent to lend, even to business, as banks continue to repair their own balance sheets. And third, businesses simply don't know what's next around the block, what's next that Congress is going to propose. In other words, there is a great deal of uncertainty. So even major companies, as well as small businesses that are profitable, are simply holding their money in abeyance. They're not reinvesting this in new equipment and new employees. That's a problem. Against all this economic news, it should come as no surprise that stocks continue to be extremely volatile. We see 150, 200-point up days, 250-point Dow down days, etc., and this is occurring almost on a daily basis. Yet in spite of the stock market volatility, our couch potato portfolio year-to-date is approximately dead even. Isn't that interesting? In other words, from January 1 through last night's close, basically the portfolio is dead even. If you decide to access the couch potato portfolio online at the WILL website, you will see that the portfolio is updated through Wednesday night's close. And the portfolio continues to outperform our benchmark S&P 500 by a little more than 2%. That's not a lot, but 2% is still 2%. So at least in the year 2010, diversification within a stock portfolio across many asset classes seems to make sense. And please keep in mind that a diversified stock portfolio is just one. It's just one element of a sound overall investment strategy, which of course includes emergency funds, savings, fixed income, and carefully, very carefully managing your debt. So, all right, that's just a brief introduction. We've hit on a number of topics, and I'd be delighted to tackle financial planning questions on these topics or, of course, what's on the minds of our listeners.
And if you do have those questions for David Sinnoh, you can give us a call at 333-9455 or outside the local calling area at 1-800-222-9455. 333-WILL, 1-800-222-WILL. Unfortunately, I don't have access to our email address, willtalk@illinois.edu. We'll make sure we get that right in September when David comes back. But you can give us a call at 333-9455, 1-800-222-9455. One thing before we move ahead, I also wanted to remind people that Parkland College's main campus is dealing with a power outage this morning. The daycare center and all computer services are closed. Registration is on hold at Parkland until power can be restored. So, once again, problems with the power at Parkland College. So if there are things you need to do there, keep in mind that that's what they're facing. Now, you mentioned the couch potato portfolio. I am a rookie at this. Explain what that comprises.
Well, the couch potato portfolio is a series of basically 8 stock indexes, which are the great big U.S. companies, the very, very small companies, the value component of the large companies, the value component of the small companies. We have REITs, real estate investment trusts, in that portfolio as well, and, of course, emerging markets and total international stock indexes. These are passively managed asset classes. In other words, we don't have a money manager buying and selling on a daily basis. These are simply mathematical indexes on a market-weighted basis. And over long, long periods of time, as I've preached for many, many years, it's tough. It's not impossible, mm-hmm. but it's very, very tough over very long periods of time to outperform indexes. It's difficult. It's not to say that it can't be done, and a number of very savvy investors can do it, but I'm sort of old-fashioned, and I don't want to spend 24/7. I have other things to do with my life than worrying about should I buy IBM and sell John Deere. Okay? That's not what I'm into. I'm into owning the entire market across broad asset classes. And again, we followed this couch portfolio for a number of years on WILL. And remember, it is a stock portfolio.
Right.
It is not fixed income. It is not emergency funds. It's just one aspect, one element of an overall and sound financial investment plan.
Even those fixed plans like that are, you know, contain some bit of risk.
Absolutely.
All right.
Absolutely.
Let's head to the phones with our first question. We have a caller on line one in St. Joseph. Good morning.
Good morning. Welcome back, David.
Thank you.
My question is regarding estate planning and insurance.
Yes.
The first question is, are IRAs and annuities that identify children as beneficiaries exempt from estate taxes at the death of the parents?
No, they are not. They are not.
Okay.
Certainly not. In other words, if you are an owner of an IRA, you are an owner of an annuity, that asset is going to be valued at the fair market value at the date of death. That's number one. And we don't know where estate taxes are going to go. Maybe Congress is going to do something about it this year. The talk is that if you have $3.5 million of assets or less at your death, that may be exempt. But keep in mind that if a child, for example, is a beneficiary of an IRA, there are especially a traditional IRA, not a Roth, but a traditional IRA,
right,
there may be income taxes to pay. If that child decides to liquidate that IRA, then that child is going to pay income tax all at once on the value of that particular IRA. That's generally not recommended. A better suggestion for a child is to take that money over the child's life expectancy. So if the IRA is set up correctly, it can be what is called an inherited IRA, and the monies can be taken over the life expectancy of a child. If a child is 20 years old, maybe there's a 50 or 60-year life expectancy, so not a lot of money would be coming out of that on a regular amortized basis. But it is part of your gross estate for federal estate tax purposes. And also, one has to remember that we often talk about federal estate tax, but we also have to talk about inheritance tax. Most states levy an inheritance tax as well. Now, usually, if you are leaving money to a child and it's not an exorbitant amount of money, then that was likely, more likely than not, to escape inheritance tax. But those rules differ in each state.
How about Illinois?
Well, in Illinois, again, you are probably, unless you are leaving well in excess of $2.5 million in an estate, then those children are likely to be exempt from inheritance tax.
Okay, great, great. And my next question is, do annual gifts like to you and Tom reduce our death tax exemptions?
Absolutely not. If you are using what is called the annual exclusion, in other words, where you're making a gift of, say, $10,000 to $13,000, say $13,000, to Tom or myself or to your children.
We'd appreciate it.
We would very much appreciate it.
Don't start writing the check now, though.
Two, there is no tax to you, the donor, no tax to the recipient, the donee. And essentially, it is a proper and lawful way to move assets out of your estate so they escape federal estate tax. So lots and lots of people do this. If you are married, then husband and wife could gift $26,000 to as many people as you want. It doesn't have to be a child. It can be anyone else. It doesn't even have to be a related party.
Okay, good. My last question regarding insurance is, what's your opinion of purchasing insurance for less than the estimated rebuild cost of a home if the owners plan to build a much smaller replacement home if they lose their current home? Say the fire or other catastrophe.
Okay, so we're taking an example of where you have a buildable lot. So right, we're starting with a buildable lot.
Correct.
And keep in mind that 90% or more of insurance fires are not total losses.
Mm-hmm.
So that's important to remember. And if you have less than a total loss and you are underinsured on that house, then the insurance company is only going to pay a percentage of that loss. So I'm not very excited about it. What I would be more excited about, more interested in, is if you are thinking of building a smaller house, then increase the deductible on your homeowner's policy.
Right.
You want to take more risk, move to a $5,000 annual deductible or a $10,000 annual deductible. That will substantially decrease the premium.
Okay.
All right.
Now, what did you say about the insurance company? If it's underinsured, what's the deal about that?
Well, if you're underinsured, if you carefully read your policy, mm-hmm. in other words, let's say that the replacement cost on your house is $200,000, mm-hmm. and you have insured your house for $100,000, mm-hmm. and there is a $75,000 loss, mm-hmm. you are 50% underinsured.
Mm-hmm.
So you will only be reimbursed 50% of the $75,000.
Oh, I see.
You see? Okay. That's the way most policies read. So you have to be very careful about whether or not your policy requires a co-insurance. In other words, you have to be properly co-insured.
Okay.
So ask your agent that question specifically. And usually in a homeowner's policy, there will be examples of how that can take place.
Okay, very good. Okay, thanks, David. Welcome back.
And thanks for your call. It's Focus on Illinois Public Media, WILL-AM. David Sino is our guest, finance professor at the U of I. Personal finance is our topic this morning. You can call us at 333-9455 or 1-800-222-9455. Caller this morning on line 2 in Pisotum. Good morning.
Good morning. Nice to talk with you. Always enjoy the program.
Thank you.
My question is, see, I'm recently retired. My wife has like a 3-year time frame before she is eligible to retire. Our son starts college next year. But because we've been frugal, everything's essentially paid off except for, you know, regular expenses. And we have a little bit of nest eggs, but not a whole lot. But anyway, because we've been frugal, we've got like $1,000 a month that we can contribute to something. And I don't know how familiar you are with, like, the Bright Start. I know you are with Roth IRAs and deferred compensation. This would be mainly through my wife since I'm retired. Which way to go? I know Bright Start, I think, goes predominantly to college. And I think there's a way with the Roth IRA you can use it for a college fund. And then the deferred compensation is just like the third option. If there's one that's better, we should divide.
Well, let me ask you this.
Uh-huh.
Do you have savings set aside for your son who is going to be attending college?
Correct. We have some.
You have some. And then you
but
have the ability to contribute. Are you intending to contribute this $1,000 of cash flow per month for college?
If that's what we need to do, yes.
Okay. Now, with respect to any of the college savings plans, for example, in Illinois, Bright Star or College Illinois, which is prepaid tuition, it's a little bit late to get involved in that with a child who is already starting college. Because if you, for example, placed money in stocks and invested in the stock side of a college education program, you really are putting your money at risk essentially in the short run. And that would not be a good idea. You just aren't in a position to take money at $1,000 a month and watch it go to $700 a month in the stock market. If you had time on your side where the child was 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 years of age, that's a different story. But not when the child is starting college next year. So you really have somewhat limited choices. I'm always in favor of saving for retirement, including a Roth IRA. But again, putting money in a Roth IRA, you really just can't generate it out and just suddenly pull it out the next year and use it for college education expenses. There are certain requirements. The Roth has to be a certain number of years of age, et cetera, typically 5 years before you want to start pulling money out of a Roth IRA. So if for a retirement vehicle, I'm 100% in favor of placing money in a Roth IRA, but I don't think it's an appropriate vehicle for college education expenses. Certainly not an annuity. That makes absolutely no sense because annuities typically are tax-deferred investments that grow over a period of time, and then the interest or dividends that you accumulate are immediately taxable. So you're in a situation where you have $1,000 of cash flow that you've already paid income tax on. And the question is, now how do I invest that, essentially? And what I would do is probably a combination of things. One is I would save for my own retirement through a Roth IRA, if you sound relatively young. And two, then I would simply use the cash flow to subsidize your son's college education. And unfortunately, there just aren't good investment vehicles that are available where you'll need the money on a monthly or quarterly basis, other than money market accounts, savings accounts, etc. So I don't have a really, really great solution for you. Am I clear that you are going to use this $1,000 a month, say it's $12,000 a year, to supplement college?
We haven't filed the form yet for the
FAFSA form?
Right, exactly.
Okay. To see what your son is eligible for?
No.
Okay. So you have to do that. And your son is starting college a year from this fall?
Correct.
Okay. So you are going to make certain that you file early, as soon as that is available to file in the fall, because that also will have an impact on what are called MAP grants. If your son is going to be pursuing a college degree in Illinois, because that money is drying up, and a lot of people didn't get MAP grants this year if they were eligible because of late filing.
I see.
All right. So my advice would be to file those forms, find out what you're going to get, and as opposed to, do your son a favor, as long as he's doing well academically, have him borrow less and supplement on a monthly basis this money. And probably the best place to put it is simply in a money market or some type of savings vehicle where you have ready access to it when you need it. Sorry, I don't have a silver bullet for you.
We've been discussing it, and I mentioned, since I always listen to you, I thought, if David comes on, I'll give him a call and see what's up, because we didn't know exactly which way to go. And then the other thing was about if my wife could increase her deferred compensation, would it make more sense to go ahead and bump up her deferred compensation or just to go ahead and stick that money away in like ladder money markets or something?
Well, you're asking two different questions. One is, does it make more sense to get a tax break from retirement? I would suggest to you that since you are retired and your wife is still working, I would rather have you fund Roth IRAs.
Okay.
All right? And then if there is money left over, then think about increasing the deferred comp.
I
think tax rates are going to go up just not only for all of us. And that Roth IRA money eventually, at least it plans to be tax-free money when you start pulling it out.
Okay.
So I think that would make the most sense.
And we already have some small established Roth IRA. Should we just add into that?
Well, you can if you're comfortable with the investments and the investment choices that you have currently with that Roth IRA plan sponsor, by all means, you can certainly do that. Alternatively, you can always start a new Roth IRA at a financial institution, a bank, a credit union, a mutual fund like Vanguard, a brokerage firm. There are just numerous choices.
Wonderful.
All right.
I really appreciate your help. Thanks so much. I wish you had that silver bullet, but I didn't think you were going to. So anyway, thanks again. Great program.
Thanks for your call. I wish there were more silver bullets, too. The collection is a little short. It always is. 333-9455, 1-800-222-9455 for personal finance questions for Professor David Sinnoh. Line 4 right now, a call in Charleston. Good morning.
Yes, I wanted to follow up on something you said in the beginning of the program. You said that you pointed out that income taxes, federal income taxes, are likely to go up for the wealthiest Americans, of which I'm one. And you also pointed out that the top 10% pay 40% of the federal
top 1%
income taxes.
Top 1%.
Top 1%.
1% pay 40%.
All right. And I'm just sort of curious, of the aggregate wealth in the U.S., how much does that top 1% get?
Pretty close. And that is a huge, huge problem.
It's about 40%.
It is.
Okay, and how about the aggregate wealth, not income, but let's say wealth excluding your house?
I don't have that statistic.
I think that's about 90%. So anyway, I was just calling because I was concerned a lot of your listeners were going to be very worried about me and my fellow high earners, and I just wanted to reassure people that we're doing just fine.
I'm happy to hear that.
Okay,
I'm happy
you.
To hear that. Please share some of your largesse with WIL.
Okay, thank you.
Okay.
Thanks for your call. 333-9455, 1-800-222-9455. We our callers come from all walks of life, and we just heard from one of them, and we hope you hear your call as well. Let's move on to line three, a call in Hidalgo. I don't know how many calls we get from Hidalgo in Jasper County. Good morning.
Morning. I was wondering about home care and nursing home care. Can you take any of that off your income tax?
Well, yes, you can. Are you paying a premium for home health for health care, or are you talking about actually the cost for nursing home care?
I'm talking about the cost for home care and nursing home care.
Okay, yes, that is a itemized medical deduction on your schedule of itemized deductions. Schedule B? Is it A or B? I've forgotten. It's one of them. And in other words, it's under your medical. So the answer is yes.
How much would you be able to take off?
Well, you write all of it off, but remember that when you itemize your medical deductions, that there is a floor that you have to reach. And that floor is 7.5% of your adjusted gross income. So let's say that someone had an adjusted gross income of $50,000. In other words, their income was $50,000. You'd multiply that number times 7.5%, which is about, what, $3,500 and some change. And the first $3,500 then would not be deductible, but everything after that would. So the bottom line is that for most folks who are receiving a substantial benefit and paying a lot of money for nursing home or home health care, most of that is likely to be deductible.
Okay, that's what I learned. Well, thanks a lot.
Okay.
Thank you for your call. David Sino is our guest this morning on Focus, and let's move right along because we've got a lot of calls waiting. This one is up in Foosland in northern Champaign County. Good morning. Good morning, line one, Foosland.
Oh, hi, yeah. This is Tom up in Foosland.
Hi, Tom.
Hi. I've got a local company managing a trust that I inherited from my parents, about $900,000. It's gone down, of course. I think they've done a fairly good job of managing it. They charge about 1.1%. So it's about $10,000 a year. Would I be better off putting that into, like, exchange-traded funds and just taking it out of a trust or having somebody else different manage it, save a little bit of management money or not?
Well, let me ask some basic questions. Is this a irrevocable trust? In other words,
yes.
Okay, so, and you are you the trustee or is the bank the trustee?
Well, the bank is the trustee.
Okay, so if the bank is the trustee, are you a beneficiary of the trust?
I think so, and me and my daughter are.
Okay.
I thought it was partners.
Becomes an active
partner when I die.
All right, well, one of the things, obviously, is to discuss the provisions of the trust with your local council so you understand exactly what rights and obligations you have as well as the trustee. Typically, if the trustee is the bank, then the bank is going to manage those funds. They're not going to give up the management of those funds. Sometimes, in the body of a legal trust document, there will be a paragraph that will say, while you are the beneficiary and the bank is the trustee, if you have a disagreement with the bank, you have the authority to change trustees to another financial institution. You probably can't become the trustee, but you may have that authority, and that would have to be within the written body, the written legal document of the trust. So you'd have to read that to see.
Okay.
Right? So my first point is simply understand your rights, your obligations under the terms of the trust. A second question, then, is what is the nature of the management of the trust, what's been happening with the actual assets, et cetera, how are they being managed, and are they being managed prudently? I obviously can't answer that question, but I think that's a question, since you have, I presume, quarterly reports of the trust, that you could sit down with your financial advisor and discuss those, or I would suggest, if you are the beneficiary, to sit down with your trustee, if you haven't, and look at the actual rate of return that you have earned over the last 1 year, 2 years, 3 years, 5 years, whatever, to see if that's reasonable as compared to some simple benchmarks.
They've done a good job, and it has outperformed the benchmark.
Well, then there isn't a lot to complain about. You raise the issue of, is a 1.1% fee reasonable? And I would tell you that it is in the ballpark, all right? That it's a little bit on the high side. Typically, trust fees run from 0.6% up to a little over 1%. So 1.1 is not unreasonable.
Okay.
Does that help?
Yeah. Now, I kind of think in the next couple of years the market's going to dive again. Is there any way to hedge against that?
Well, again, hedging against what you believe is something that you should take up with the trust itself. Usually trusts, because they have fiduciary responsibility to the beneficiaries and they operate under what are called the prudent investor rules, the way they hedge is they will have a typical large amount of the assets in fixed income or money markets or short-term fixed income, so that if stocks go down, there is a buffer of fixed income which sort of offsets that impact. Typically, trusts will not hedge by using some type of derivative strategy because they can get themselves in trouble with the prudent investor rule.
Okay.
So there's not much leeway for trustees to invest.
And does your trust document, or do you know whether or not your trust document lays out what the trust can invest in?
I don't think it does. I'll have to go back and reread it carefully.
Right. I think you need to study that trust document. And then I think it is prudent at least once every 6 months to 12 months to visit and have a conversation, if not more often, with your trustee, and just so that you're all on the same page.
Well, I generally have, I've only had this in trust for about 2-3 years, so it's been pretty rocky, you know.
Yeah, it's been a tough time. It's been a tough time. And if they've outperformed benchmarks and hung in there pretty well, then my reaction would be to, visit with them, educate yourself, and be part of the process.
Okay.
All right. Thank you for your call. Personal finance is our topic on Focus this morning on WILL AM, Illinois Public Media. I'm Tom Rogers. David Sinnoh, as we have once a month, is our guest answering those questions. Let's move on to a call on line two. It's in Champaign. Good morning.
Good morning. My question is, I'm 58 and a half, and I'm considering, if things don't change, and who knows if they will, and I've got two young kids, one 10 and one 6, and I was thinking about when I turn 62, draw on Social Security and continue to work, mainly so I could get it for the kids. And what are the things I need to consider, assuming I can even do that then?
Well, all right, those are great questions, and interestingly enough, there's just a tremendous amount of information and literally scores of articles in every periodical journal talking about the fact that many, many people are taking their Social Security benefits at age 62. And as a result, there is an actual negative cash flow for the first time on Social Security. In other words, the amount of payroll taxes coming in are not quite enough to service all of the Social Security benefits that are being paid out. That's never happened before. And part of that is because well over 2.5 million people who have turned 62 are now accessing Social Security benefits where for most of them, their normal retirement age is 66.
Why would they do that?
They don't have a job.
Oh, well.
They don't have a job.
I was going to say, it's a personal choice. Maybe it's not.
It is. And for a lot of them, it is the only choice because they need the money.
Right.
The problem is that you take a gigantic haircut when you take the money at 62,
right.
About 25%. So if you were going to get $1,000 a month, you're going to get about $750 a month. And then going forward each year, based upon inflation, that number, of course, moves up. But you're shortchanging yourself a bit, although many, many people need that money and hence are taking it at age 62. Here's the rub, though. If you retire and start accessing your Social Security benefits before normal retirement age, which for most of us is 66, and some of us are 67, there are dollar limits on how much you can earn before you have to start giving your Social Security back. That's the problem. And typically that number is around, oh, I don't have it in front of me, call it about $14,000. So if you go out and you work part-time or work full-time, draw your Social Security at 62, and earn more than $14,000, for every dollar you earn in excess of that approximate amount, and I'm just using that as an approximation, you got to give 50 cents back of your Social Security. That's a problem. Now, that doesn't impact you if you have interest income, dividend income, trust income, rental income. But if you've got income from the sweat of your brow where you're actually an employee or you're working for yourself, one, you're going to pay Social Security payroll tax on that money. And two, if you earn too much, you got to give your Social Security benefits back. So there is a disincentive to work full-time if you are taking your Social Security benefits before your normal retirement age, typically 66. Now, does that make sense?
Yeah, but still you haven't addressed the two little kids part of it.
Okay, the two little kids, and you're trying to take that money and use that for their health, education, and welfare?
Yeah.
Okay. So are you intending to work part-time up to that limit when you would reach 62?
No, I would still – I'm figuring on working as long as I can work.
Okay. Well, then you wouldn't be taking your Social Security at 62 because you'd have to end – you might end up giving it all back.
Well, that's what I'm trying to figure out, if it's worth me losing what I will lose to gain what the kids would gain. See what I mean?
Yeah, and I think you have to sit down with your financial planner because you've got to look at all of the income that you've got from all sources. I think you're going to come to the conclusion that you'll be better off working full-time, that that will be a better deal than dropping down and taking those Social Security benefits.
Okey-doke.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right, thanks for your call. Now, once you decide to start taking Social Security,
can you stop?
Below that, can you take a little hiatus? Say, I'm gonna work now. I'm 63 now.
Absolutely.
I've been here for a year.
Yes, you can.
I'll see you when I'm 66.
You can do that. It's a little bit more complicated than that, but the answer is yes.
How complicated is it, and is it worth it in many cases?
Well, in most cases, it would not be worth it.
Oh, okay. But it's possible.
Absolutely.
All
absolutely.
Right. Let us move on now to a call on line 4 in Aurora. Good morning.
Yes, good morning. My question is in regards to what you were talking earlier about IRAs, Roth IRAs.
Yes.
Now, I have a handful of different Roth IRAs. They're all Roth.
Okay.
I've converted them over time. But I was wondering, now, if I were to combine all those, would that come under that five-year rule? If I were to combine, like, let's just say five into one?
Well, that's an interesting question. Are some of your Roths less than 5 years old?
No, they're all – I converted them. It's been longer than 5 years.
Okay. So, number one, could you convert them into one master Roth IRA with one provider? The answer is clearly yes. That's a tax-free event. Roth IRAs are tax-free to begin with, so you'd simply be essentially moving your money trustee to trustee. So there's no income tax impact in doing that. Was that your question?
Well, because you had mentioned there was something about a five-year rule that they had to be over 5 years. So I just didn't know if I started a new one, if that meant that five-year rule had to kick start all over again.
No, it does not. Okay. As long as if you have a master Roth IRA and you're putting more money into it each year, if you're 5 years into your Roth IRA program, you've met that five-year requirement.
Is there any advantages or disadvantages to combining them all into one?
Well, I think the advantage is simplicity. That's the major advantage.
You're right about that.
As long as, because I just hate getting paperwork from 7 or 8 different entities. I would just hate that. And as long as you have a master entity that can provide you the diversification that you demand, there's no problem with that.
Okay. Thank you.
And thanks for your call. We've got time for a couple more questions. 333-9455, 1-800-222-9455 for David Sino. Let's move on to line 3 in Urbana. Good morning.
Good morning. I have two questions.
Mm-hmm.
I have 403B. Yeah.
Yep.
Accounts at two different mutual fund places, one I like and one I don't like. I have quite a bit less money in the one I don't like.
That's
but
good.
I would like to move the money to the one I like.
Can you do that? The answer is yes.
Okay. Is this a big deal?
No, it is not.
And if I call the one I like, Vanguard, and say, I want to do this, can they help me with that?
They can. They will probably even provide you with the paperwork. But ultimately, you're going to have to get paperwork from your other provider as well.
Okay.
All right, because you'll probably have to use the provider's paperwork where you're moving from, and Vanguard then would be accepting this money.
Okay.
All right, but no, you can work. You're perfectly capable of working your way through the paperwork.
And there aren't any tax disadvantages?
Absolutely not. This will be a trustee-to-trustee transfer.
Okay.
The money will move directly from your unhappy trustee to your happier trustee.
Okay, one other question. This
yes.
is an IRS question. I have a rental property. I started out thinking I was going to just replace the floor of a front porch. But when we went to get the building permit, it turned into a bigger deal. So we replaced it. This is like a Victorian building.
Okay.
So we replaced the posts, the floor, and the stairs, but we didn't replace the roof. Can I deduct this as a repair, or do I have
That's
to?
A great question, isn't it? Yeah, I knew your question. Do you want to expense it, or do you want to depreciate
exactly.
it?
Exactly.
And I presume that you have an accountant.
No, I do that myself.
Oh, well, that you do it yourself.
Uh-huh.
I hesitate to give you advice about that. I'm
give
sorry.
Me your, I, top I, of your head.
I
like,
think,
are there any general rules on
Well,
the
I think if it was a small amount of money that you could expense it.
It's
not a small amount of money to be on the safe side and to do it correctly, that would require depreciation.
Depreciation.
Yes.
Okay, is that straight line?
Yes, it would be. This is a rental property.
Uh-huh.
27 and a half years straight line.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Pleasure.
All right. Some answers are not as easily found as others. 333-9455, 1-800-222-9455. Questions for David Sino. We revisit Charleston on line 1. Good morning.
Good morning. Quickly, I am an employee of the state. My wife is recently retired, and we are looking to improve the efficiency of our heating and air conditioning system. I know you're not Mr. Spies, but there's a tax credit for these. And what I've understood, though, is that you have to owe the feds money to get the tax credit. And so my question is, do I contact my benefits office and say, stop withholding federal tax payments in order to build up to this? I think it's up to $8,000.
Yeah, it is, and there's also an income limitation limit as well. So you better make certain that you meet the income limitation limit.
Okay.
As far as the thrust of your question as to whether you have to owe the government, I'm sorry, I'm just not an expert in that area.
Okay.
And that's something that you would have to bring up with your accountant or ask an accountant who has really knowledge in that area. That's beyond my purview, I'm
sure.
afraid.
That's a tax question.
But it is it's a more complicated tax question. Uh-huh. But it's certainly something that you may well be able to take advantage of, and I applaud you for, you know, going ahead and looking at that carefully.
Well, I'll investigate it yet more.
Okay.
Thanks very much.
My pleasure.
All right, man. Thank you for your call. Got about 7 or 8 minutes left on the show and time for a couple more calls. So you can still call us 333-9455, 1-800-222-9455, slip in under the wire. And line four, we have a call in Des Plaines. Good morning.
Good morning, Dr. Sinoff.
Good morning.
As I said earlier, welcome back.
Thank you so much.
A question came up over dinner last night, two-part question. The first question is, does it look as if we're going to get a Social Security cost of living this year, and what's the impact on the economy if we don't?
It's been a while since there has been one, right?
Well, last year we skipped,
but the year before it was pretty substantial. It
yes.
was in excess of 5%.
Wow.
Yes.
So people who were on Social Security got a positive little hit on their Social Security. But last
had to keep
year
them for a couple
zero.
Of years. Yeah.
And it looks thus far, it's anybody's guess based upon where we're going to be with respect to inflation for the rest of the year. But right now, as I recall, we're about delta neutral, so there isn't much cooking in terms of increases for Social Security at the moment.
Is that strictly based on the inflation rate?
Yeah, it's based on a complicated inflation index, mm-hmm. and at the moment, I believe that index is about zero.
Right.
So right now, I don't think we're looking at any at least substantial increase in Social Security next year.
And the impact on the general economy if the retirees who are subject to Social Security can't receive that cost of living?
Well, I'm not certain what the impact is. Let's think through that for a moment, because the government, that's you and I, are essentially borrowing that money to put in the hands of people who are Social Security recipients. So on
yes.
one hand, we're increasing the amount of our national debt. On the other hand, we're putting money in Social Security recipients' hands. And if they spend the money, then that obviously would stimulate the economy. If, however, they save the money, then it really doesn't have a great stimulus effect on the economy. So it's probably about a wash.
Uh-huh.
All right? That's probably about the impact. Unfortunately, Medicare and out-of-pocket medical expenses are going up for all of us, including the elderly. So as a result, if we don't have a Social Security increase, we may find out that as a result of increased medical bills and Medicare expenses, that we are actually falling further behind.
Yes, yes.
And I think that's probably part of your discussion last night.
Right.
Yes, it was, and you anticipated my follow-up there. I was afraid of that, but I guess I better live with reality then.
I guess we are. All of us are going to be living with reality here.
Thank you, sir.
Oh, my pleasure.
Thanks for your call. And one other question that I had in mind was, you know, God forbid we have negative inflation, deflation.
Deflation.
Is there something, is there a provision in Social Security where you could have a cost of living decrease?
No.
It never goes down?
No.
Okay.
No, we don't have that, and that's a very, very negative impact on our economy.
But
far worse, really, than inflation.
Right. But at the very least, Social Security recipients can be assured that their benefits are not going to go down. Let's take one last call in Urbana. Good morning.
Hi. In response to the earlier caller who wanted to know about tax credits for increasing the efficiency of his air conditioning or whatever it was, having looked into it, my understanding is that you have to be paying in income tax that year. However, his other part of his question was, should he reduce the amount of his the deductions from his paycheck so he pays a larger amount later? It doesn't make any difference because all of what you are considered to be paying on your income tax includes what is deducted from a paycheck and whatever else you do when you file your taxes to balance what's still owed. So it's that whole amount that you pay.
Okay, and you've been through this process.
Pardon?
You've been through the process.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So it's your understanding, it's fair to say, that let's say that my taxes for the year were $5,000.
Including what's been withheld.
Yeah, including what's been withheld or what will be withheld, it's $5,000. That's basically what I can offset. Is that your understanding?
I forget now whether there's a limit.
There is a limit, subject to the limit.
But you
subject to the limit.
His question was whether he had to also change his deductions.
I don't think so. I wouldn't think so.
And he doesn't because the whole thing is.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense.
Yeah.
Good.
If I have a chance to add something separate.
Very
sure.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that I just finally decided to do to manage my donations so that I wouldn't put them off to the end of the year is I use Quicken on my computer to keep track of my the checks that I write and so forth. And there's a feature where you can put in scheduled transactions. So I decided to divide up the groups that I know I want to give to for the year and spread them out over the year. And a reminder comes up that I wanted to write a check. It doesn't actually write the check. It doesn't commit me to writing the check, but it's a reminder. And I find it helpful to keeping track of which groups I've given to as well, so that when I get multiple reminders, I just say, oops, I've already given to them.
What a great idea.
Thanks.
Thanks for sharing that.
Okay, bye.
But there really is no, it's great to budget that out and make sure that you can do them all at one time. So you don't do it all at once on December 31st before you forget.
I think most people periodically give through the year anyway.
Yeah, yeah. Payroll deduction is good for that.
Absolutely.
And obviously those computer programs, they allow you to get those reminders every now and then.
No question. And a lot of people do their charitable giving through payroll deduction, mm-hmm. whether it's going to the United Way or the University of Illinois or Friends of the Library, whomever it may be going to.
And the tax deductibility of that doesn't change no matter which process you're using, whether you're physically writing a check or deducting it for your payroll.
Absolutely.
It's just a little tougher, maybe actually easier to keep track of, I suppose.
Mm-hmm.
Most
is.
People get a statement at the end of the year that you can use for taxes?
Absolutely. If, in fact, charities are required to provide those statements
right.
at the end of the year.
All right. David Sinnoh, thanks for your time this morning.
Well, it's been lots of fun, lots of great questions. And I want to thank all of the listeners and all of the folks who called in. And I want to wish them a very, very happy and pleasurable weekend.
And we will see you in September, as it were.
Absolutely.